foes, they're in business together. Daddy Bush knows the Carlyle Group, since years before, been raking in billions and itching for more. It's blood for oil.
That was Emma's Revolution, and I'm Marcy Winograd. Welcome to Code Pink Radio, presented by WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, and lots of other community radio stations such as KBOO in Portland. You can also hear us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Do check out our website at codepink.org, where you'll find the latest on our campaigns and all of our radio episodes and podcasts. On this Code Pink radio podcast, we will visit Chicago, where activists were successful in passing a ceasefire resolution at the Chicago City Council. Then on to Congress, where Code Pink challenged U.S. defunding of UNRWA, the UN Relief Works Agency, the lifeline for food and water to over 2 million people in Gaza. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, will talk to us about the protest in front of Secretary of State Antony Blinken's house in Virginia. And on the second half of our show, we'll hear from Francis Boyle, the human rights lawyer who successfully argued before the World Court to hold Yugoslavia accountable for genocide. He'll share with us his insights on enforcement of the court's orders to Israel to stop killing Palestinians and provide humanitarian aid. All that and more on Code Pink Radio.
He voted aye!
Hi, it's Newt with Code Pink, and I'm here outside Chicago City Hall because today the Chicago City Council made history by being the first major city in the U.S. to pass a ceasefire resolution. After weeks of advocating here in the Chicago City Council, of getting kicked out, of being censored, of some of our Palestinian organizers and their allies losing their jobs over their advocacy for Palestine, today Chicago made a statement and said that they stand with Palestine and they stand against genocide, regardless of whether or not our federal government continues to send funds and weapons to Israel to continue the genocide on Gaza. Today Chicago stood against that and said that we will not stand with genocide and we stand with the people of Palestine.
Code Pink's Palestine campaigner Noor was at Chicago City Hall when Mayor Brandon Johnson cast the tie-breaking vote for the City Council's support for a ceasefire in Gaza. Chicago Alderwoman Rosanna Rodriguez, who introduced the ceasefire resolution, explained how her solidarity with Palestine is informed by her experience resisting U.S. militarism and colonialism in Puerto Rico.
I am Puerto Rican. I lived under colonialism. I had to do civil disobedience in Vieques to prevent 9,000 people from continuing to be bombed by the U.S. Navy. But we also went through Hurricane Maria. We saw the bodies piling up because of lack of water. We are the colony of the most powerful country in the world with the most powerful army in the world. And they let 5,000 people die of preventable causes. We saw the bodies piling up, and there was no space because there were so many. And we still had to go to work every day, knowing that people were dying. People died because there was no electricity, and they couldn't do dialysis, blood transfusions. And we had to show up every day in our lives, knowing that people were dying every day and that we couldn't do anything about it. And I see the Palestinian community facing that every single day and knowing that today more people are going to die and that tomorrow more people are going to die and people are going to continue to die until a ceasefire is achieved. And the only way to achieve that is to demonstrate consensus in this country.
Who has a long time plan of getting rid of the lifeline for the Palestinians? You cannot take the word of Israel, who is torturing prisoners who have been charged with nothing, and use that as evidence. They have no evidence. They have been fired already. You are taking their lifeline.
From the halls of Congress at a hearing on defunding the UN relief agency, UNRWA, to outside Secretary of State Antony Blinken's home, Code Pink was there. Listen.
I'm Marcy Winograd. I'm with Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink. Greetings, Medea. I hear you've been busy outside Secretary of State Blinken's house. Tell us about it.
Well, I've been joining a wonderful group that has been there for the last over a week now, and it's quite remarkable. This is literally outside his fence, on the grass in front of his fence, and across the street, where there are tents that have been set up, people have been sleeping overnight, and every day, as soon as the police allow them to make noise, because there's a, quote, noise ordinance, so I think it's at 10 in the morning till 9 at night, you can hear the chanting. I go to bed, even in my own home, with that in my ears. It's Bloody Blinken, Secretary of Genocide, over and over and over. They pour blood as his car enters and leaves. Fake blood, of course. It's paint. And there are the nanny comes in and out. The woman who cleans the house goes in and out. And Blinken goes in and out. And his wife and kids go in and out. And they have to face that angry group of people who are saying to him that he is a genocide supporter. So it has been very exciting. Marcy, one thing I just can't believe is that this Camp Blinken is not national news. Wouldn't you think that a camp out outside the Secretary of State's house would be worthy of being on CNN and other of the national TV stations?
You would think that, but we know that there's tremendous censorship right now, and everything seems to be filtered through the White House. I can't think of a Helen Thomas, Matt Lee of Associated Press. I'm trying to get him out there. He's one of the few who's been asking some tough questions at these press briefings. So you're in Virginia, is that right? When you're outside his home?
Yes, it's in Arlington, Virginia. And more and more people have been going. They keep saying, well, we're going to shut this down. And then they decide to keep it going. And there's a remarkable woman named Hasami who is leading this whole thing. And she's doing lots and lots of Instagram lives. So people can go to her Instagram. It's Hazami, Hazami, and follow what's going on there.
And has he engaged at all? Does he look your way? Any kind of interaction?
No. We can peek through the fence and see him getting into his car. And then he looks down and they don't look at us, but sure, they sure know what's going on there. And we're saying that while people in Gaza don't have a roof over their head, don't have food, medicines, or starving, that we won't give him peace in his own luxury mansion. So it's been a great camp out, and I just wish it would get more national attention.
Yes, well, we'll do our part on Code Pink Radio, and I think that's another campaign. Reporters, head to Virginia, Arlington. That's where the action is. So, you know, people listening might think, well, Secretary of State Blinken, he's a mild-mannered guy. He seems to be mild-mannered. He plays music. I forget what instrument. And he's with the State Department. Yet, we know this man is not supporting peace. In fact, quite the opposite. Every time I see him on Twitter, he's standing with somebody else, some other leader of another country. And I say, and invariably I'll say, you know, in my tweets, don't stand next to Secretary of State Blinken. He really is the Secretary of Genocide, as you said. All along throughout Biden's presidency, Blinken has said our commitment, the United States government's commitment to Israel is ironclad. And even now, there's no support for a ceasefire at the White House, at least not publicly. I'm sure some of the staff support a ceasefire.
We know that some of the staff, and we certainly know that even the young people, the interns there are not happy. And Marcy, one of the most amazing things that I find in all of this is how much internal dissent there is. So we see it in the AID, where over 1,000 of the staff people have written an anonymous letter. But now we see people speaking out, even when the head of AID, Samantha Power, is having any public meetings, there are people speaking out. We see it, of course, in the Congress as we go there. when there are staff members who have written letters saying that they don't agree with what their bosses are doing. And when we're in the offices every single day, we get staff members coming up to us. If they can't do it in their office, they do it when we're in the hall or when we're in the cafeteria or somewhere, saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. We're really with you. We're trying to convince our bosses. There is so much disgust within the establishment itself. And then, of course, the growing disruptions that are happening as Biden goes out on the campaign trail, starting to get into campaign mode. They don't know how to deal with it. You know what they've been, one of the things they've been doing, Marcy, is excluding any woman who is wearing a headscarf. And
wow,
just saying, you can't get in. And they say, well, I have a ticket. And they say, yeah, well, we don't want you in here. So they are doing some really terrible racial profiling to try to keep people away who might be protesting, even though in the articles in CNN and other places, they say, oh, we're not trying to keep protesters out. They sure are. I had a ticket to go to Biden's event in Manassas and couldn't get in. And neither could most of our Code Pink people. They are screening people like crazy.
So the Biden campaign team is discriminating against anyone, any woman who looks like an observant Muslim, basically, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. And we have been going with some of our friends who have been the victims of this kind of discrimination to the groups like CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, and American Muslims for Palestine, and saying, you know, we want to lodge complaints. We went to the DNC, the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee here in Washington, D.C., to complain. And we think it's important to get this out to the media as well, to tell them that this is just unacceptable. But, you know, I say it because it just reflects the amount of anger that there is. We've seen as Biden has been traveling to Michigan that the leaders of the Muslim community and the Palestinian community don't even want to meet with him because they're so disgusted. So he is really losing ground, and he knows it, but yet he still won't change course.
Well, that is really disturbing, Medea. You know, I didn't know that they're racially profiling people as they attend these events for Biden. But we are hearing, I mean, Politico has been writing about all the disruptions. Of course, people are outraged. It's hard for me to sleep. I mean, this genocide is being live streamed into our living rooms, and it's impossible to ignore. And when I call people on Capitol Hill, Congress members, what I'm hearing is, oh yes, we are getting calls 10 to 1 for a ceasefire. And yet so few, I can't think of a senator, maybe there's one or two, who have called for a ceasefire, but we did get some news.
There's six of them.
Okay.
So, and the latest one was Van Hollen, and that was good. You know, he's been getting a lot of grief from his district, and he went recently to the Rafah border and wrote a letter that has been signed by 25 other senators, which is a half of the Democratic senators, really excoriating the administration for not doing more to get in humanitarian aid. And while we would like them to say, well, number one thing is a ceasefire, at least they are saying that there needs to be a humanitarian pause. They need to streamline the process so that this aid gets in. They need to open more ways for the aid to get in, not only things like Erez Crossing in Israel, but also looking into the aid getting in from Jordan, from the West Bank. And they even talk about by sea. And I think this is because Van Hollen and Merkley went to the border and they were disgusted by what they saw. They saw the hundreds of trucks lined up. They were told that it takes weeks for a vehicle to get in. They went to the warehouse to see all the things that the Israelis rejected from going inside. So there's a lot more anger growing inside of Congress, saying that, you know, even if we're not coming out clearly for a ceasefire, we're not happy with what the administration is doing or not doing to push for humanitarian aid. And as you know, there has been a pause in the money going to the UN relief agency called UNRWA, and many of the members of the Democratic Party are saying, no, there has to be an opening again. That money has to go there because that's the only agency that can provide some of this aid. So at least on the aid side, we see more concern coming from Congress.
Yes, when you consider that Van Hollen and Murphy co-authored this letter and it's been signed by 23 other senators. That's half the Senate is outraged at the Biden administration, which is now bombing Iraq and Syria and escalating to widen this conflict. I don't want to even call it a war because it's a genocide in Gaza, but to engage others and, you know, the bombing of Yemen recently, because why? Because the people there are blockading the Red Sea, blockading Israeli ships, or rather ships that are bound for Israel, and saying that they want to uphold the convention, the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide. And to think that this might be settled, well, the worst of it could be settled were we to say we support a ceasefire, were the Biden administration to say we support a ceasefire, and instead of circumventing Congress to send millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in weapons to Israel without congressional approval, if President Biden and Secretary of State Blinken, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, and others in that administration said, we want to end the fighting, we want to cease fire now, then we wouldn't have to witness perhaps what we are witnessing today, and that is the bombing of Iraq and Syria and Yemen.
Well, right. And we were in a hearing just the other day, Marcy, where they were bringing in people who are experts in the shipping industry to say, what are we going to do? These commercial ships are being stopped and we can't allow that to happen. And they're going on and on for 2 hours about, well, you know, what can we do? And talking about ridiculous things instead of saying, all right, what's at the basis of this problem. In fact, they brought in, quote, witnesses who said, oh, well, even if the Israelis stopped the bombing, this wouldn't stop the Houthis because they want to just take over the whole area, and just made up stuff. We have heard directly from the Houthis that the interference with commercial traffic in the Red Sea would stop immediately if the Israelis stopped their assault on Gaza. But the United States is so intent on not dealing with the root of the problem and instead widening this war, attacking the Houthis. And, you know, Marcy, it's amazing how much support the Houthis have gotten because of this. Even their enemies that they've been fighting with for the last 7-8 years are now applauding them for this, and all over the Arab world. And if you've seen any of the rallies that have happened, and they've been going on every Friday after prayers in Yemen, you see the unbelievable numbers of people that come out in the streets to say, you know, turn another ship around that's bound for Israel. So if the U.S. wants to decrease the influence of the Houthis, they're doing just the opposite.
Absolutely. And if the U.S. wanted to end this misery, they could say ceasefire now, and we won't be sending any more weapons to Israel. I think if the United States, if Congress or the White House said to Netanyahu, we're not going to send you one more weapon, this would be over. This would end. I do believe that, you know. Instead, what are we hearing? Oh, I saw a press release that the White House is going to impose sanctions on a couple of people who are settlers or supporting settlers in the West Bank. This is ridiculous. You know, another case of gaslighting. You know, when you consider that all of Gaza, their plan is to settle all of Gaza. Some of these, thousands in Israel want to settle Gaza.
Yes, settlers. You look at the gathering that they had recently, it just sends chills up and down your spine to see them jumping up and down so excited about the possibility of entering Gaza and creating new settlements there. It is nuts.
It absolutely is. I often say Zionism, you know, this belief that Jews must have a Jewish defined state, this is a driver of anti-Semitism. And instead, everything's upside down and people are being accused of being anti-Semitic if they're anti-Zionist.
Well,
so
and
now.
And if they're against the AIPAC money that is so distorting our foreign policy, to look at all this pro-Israel money and say, you know, this has to be a major factor in the policy decisions taken by members of the Congress. And when you call them out on AIPAC, they love to say, oh, well, that's anti-Semitic as well. No, 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 not in the least. That is just saying we don't want our democracy so distorted by this money. And it is important to call out AIPAC. I just talked to somebody from some of the Jewish organizations, and they want to really get 100 members of Congress to pledge that they won't take AIPAC money, or 100 members of Congress that includes people who are running for Congress. And I think that's a great goal that we should all get on board and really push our members of Congress to say, stop taking AIPAC money, that we won't believe while you take AIPAC money, we won't believe you when you say that your vote is not influenced by that. The only way that you can convince us is to stop taking that money.
Exactly. I like the pledge idea. I also like how you posted on some of the congressional representatives' offices, the outside of their offices, the amount of money that they had received from AIPAC. That was bold.
We're putting out a lot of videos on social media where we put our interactions with these Congress people that we have been bird dogging as they go in and out of hearings, or they go in and out of their office, or they're going to a vote in the Capitol and we're running after them. And we post the videos of their responses, which is oftentimes not to even talk to us, and put in how much money they are getting from AIPAC. So I think this campaign to expose the influence of AIPAC is absolutely critical. You know, there is the $14 billion that Congress is trying to send to Israel in the middle of a genocide. And then there's the $3.8 billion that we give every year to Israel. And all of this money has to stop. The only way we're going to stop it is just if we keep up this effort to say, don't take money from pro-Israel lobbies and don't give any of our tax dollars to Israel.
Amen. And reinstate the money for UNRWA, as you mentioned earlier. That's the lifeline for Gaza, the supplier of water, food, medicine. And here we have a long list. Well, I consider it a long list of countries who, in response to a report from Israeli intelligence that there were some UNRWA employees involved or complicit in the Hamas attacks, they have suspended aid, half of the budget of UNRWA has been decimated by the suspension of the United States, Japan, Germany, Switzerland, Canada, Australia, and on and on. This, to me, is the imposition of mass starvation. If anybody doubted that the United States was aiding and abetting genocide, they should now know that the United States is not just aiding and abetting, the United States is perpetrating genocide by withholding water, food, and medicine.
Well, that's right. And people have shown documents that prove that there has been a long-term campaign to try to get rid of UNRWA. And now they see as the moment to really implement this. And of course, it's part of a larger strategy to make it impossible for Palestinians to continue to live in Gaza so that they will leave. And we cannot let the Israelis be successful in that campaign. And part of that is just to demand the restoration of that money to UNRWA. One thing that we don't want is when the Congress people tell us, well, I had to vote for the $14 billion because it had some hundreds of millions of dollars in there for humanitarian aid. And we say, you know, we can see right through that trick. We don't want any money going to bombs, and we do want money going to help people who are starving.
Exactly. Tucking in $100 million or even $2 billion for aid to be spread amongst Israel, Ukraine, and Gaza, to say that we're going to tuck in this money, we're going to package this with $61 billion to continue the war in Ukraine, $14.5 billion for more weapons for Israel, billions more for Taiwan to prepare for China. That is a charade. And I'm so glad that people are calling that out. Now, in terms of UNRWA and reinstating the money, one thing that Code Pink is doing, I know you're aware, is we are tweeting to some of the press corps, the White House press corps, And at codepink.org, you can see what we are tweeting. But basically, some of the questions that we want asked at these press briefings with the White House include, so what is your plan now to avoid, avert mass starvation in Gaza now that you have suspended aid to UNRWA, the lifeline for water, food, and medicine for Gaza? What's your plan? And was this announcement that you're suspending aid or this decision, was this in retaliation for the decision, the ruling of the World Court that, yes, there is a plausible case that Israel has committed genocide? And yes, we do need orders. And one of the orders is that Israel is not to kill Palestinians as a member of a group with genocidal intent. Israel is not to deny water, food, and medicine. Israel is to supply humanitarian aid and is not to transfer children from one place to another. That's called ethnic cleansing. And yet we see Israel flagrantly violating these orders.
Well, that's right. And I think, you know, the world has seen through this and is horrified by the policies of the United States and some of the Western, quote, democracies. But more and more people in the U.S. are seeing through it. And with an election time coming up, this is the time to make it known that it's not just Arab Americans or young people who are disgusted that Biden is supporting this genocide, but it's a lot of us and a lot of people who have been lifelong Democrats who are saying, I just can't bring myself to vote for Joe Biden. I can't bring myself to remain part of the Democratic Party. And they've got to hear this loud and clear, because if they don't understand the moral imperative, at least they might understand the electoral imperative.
Thank you so much, Medea, for sharing your political and your personal views on voting. I have to say, I would never want to put my seal of approval on anyone who's perpetrating genocide. So with that, I want to thank you, Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, who's on Capitol Hill virtually every day. Also outside Secretary of State Blinken's home to say, you are the Secretary of Genocide and you need to stop. So thank you for joining us.
Nice to be on with you, Marcy. Thank you.
Coming up, an interview with international human rights attorney Frances Boyle on possible consequences for Israel violating the recent World Court's orders.
الصبح بكير منحط بودرة ومناكير مندور عن معنى قوانين بدها تكسير منقول الله كبير منشكي ما حدا بسمعنا حاسي حالي بتحرك لحالي بزحمة سير عم تخنق خيالي أقنية بتنطبع تمشي بالشارع أسهم بتقشر بس طريقي بالجهة التانية يا بنت حكيك خطير خلي سرك بالبير بلاش حدا يسمعنا بتعرفي شو ممكن يصير بطل واضح كتير مين ضدنا ومين معنا حاسي حالي بتحرك لحالي بزحمة سير عم تخنق خيالي أقنية بتنطبع تمشي بالشارع أسهم بتقشر بس طريقي
Welcome back to Code Pink Radio. That was Palestinian vocalist Haya Zatri with Borders and Promises. And I'm Marcy Winograd. Next up, South Africa takes Israel to the World Court for the crime of genocide. And the World Court rules South Africa has a plausible case. The president of the International Court of Justice, Joan Donoghue, reads the provisional orders to Israel.
The court considers that, with regard to the present situation, Israel must, in accordance with its obligations under the Genocide Convention, in relation to Palestinians in Gaza, take all measures within its power to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of Article 2 of the Convention, in particular, A, killing groups members of the group, B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and D, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. The court recalls that these acts fall within the scope of Article 2 of the Convention when they are committed with the intent to destroy in whole or in part the group as such. The court is also of the view that Israel must take measures within its power to prevent and punish the direct and public incitement to commit genocide in relation to the members of the Palestinian group in the Gaza Strip.
I'm Marcy Winograd, and it's my honor to interview Frances Boyle, international human rights attorney, to Code Pink Radio. Frances Boyle is a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law, who successfully represented Bosnia in its genocide case against the former Yugoslavia. Frances Boyle is the author of a number of books, including The Bosnian People Charge Genocide, Palestine, Palestinians and International Law and World Politics, Human Rights and International Law. Welcome, Frances Boyle, to Code Pink Radio.
Well, Marcy, thank you very much for having my best to all my good friends there at Code Pink.
Yes, we're thrilled to host you today. All right, so Frances Boyle, tell us about your success first representing Bosnia before the International Court of Justice, also known as the World Court, and how your experience before this court might inform us about consequences for Israel if it continues to violate the orders to stop killing Palestinians and to provide humanitarian aid.
Well, Marcy, I was the first lawyer to win an order from the World Court on the basis of the Genocide Convention. That was 8 April 1993. It was massive, overwhelming in favor of Bosnia against Yugoslavia to cease and desist from committing all acts of genocide against the Bosnians. And then I won a second order on 13 September 1993, pretty much to the same effect, massive, overwhelming for Bosnia-Herzegovina against Yugoslavia. This was the first time ever that any lawyer or government had won two orders in one World Court lawsuit since the World Court was founded in 1921. And then I also won a third order, what's known as an Article 74-4 order from the president of the court, exercising the powers of the court. That was on August 1993. So I won three orders in 6 months. In addition, acting on behalf of my clients, the mothers of Srebrenica and Podrina, the women who survived the massacre of Srebrenica, I convinced the ICTY prosecutor, International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia prosecutor, Carla Del Ponte, to indict Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic for almost every crime in the ICTY statute book, including two counts of genocide, one for genocide in Bosnia in general, and the second for genocide of Srebrenica in particular. He was put on trial in The Hague. He filed a motion to dismiss all charges. The tribunal ruled that the prosecution had produced enough evidence to convict him on all charges, including the two counts of genocide, and that he should then open his defense, whereupon he died. So we never got a final verdict there. But based on then my knowledge, judgment, and experience, when South Africa filed the lawsuit against Israel on behalf of the Palestinians, I did read through their application request for provisional measures of protection, and I began giving interviews saying South Africa was going to win. And they did win. I didn't think it would be so massive and overwhelming. I thought that Israel, as you know, started a diplomatic campaign to bring pressure to bear on the judges. I thought some of them might succumb to that pressure, but they didn't. Most of the provisional measures were 15 to 2, 16 to 1. But it was clear South Africa was going to win. And you can Google that. You'll see the reason I say that. I did all that work for Bosnia by myself. I was assisted by some students who helped put together documentation, but I was the only lawyer on that case. The work product by the team of lawyers in South Africa was excellent and far superior to mine. I mean, they had a whole team there. And so my conclusion was, if I could do all that by myself, certainly the South African lawyers and their work product, which was outstanding, both the application and the request for provisional measures of protection were going to win, and they did win. So that was, a week ago. We're still dealing with the consequences under the terms of the statute of the World Court. That order was transmitted to the UN Security Council under the terms of the United Nations Charter. It is for the Security Council to enforce the order. It's just like any other legal proceeding. You go to a judge, you get an order. If the defendant does not comply, you go to the sheriff. You don't expect the judge to enforce it. So right now, the matter is pending before the Security Council. The latest report as of this matter is that Algeria has drafted a resolution for the Security Council, has circulated it to the members of the Security Council. It's not a matter of public record yet, so I haven't read the text, but it calls for a ceasefire and massive humanitarian assistance to the Palestinians in Gaza. The U.S. ambassador says she's opposes it, which apparently then means there will be a veto sometime later this week. That will not be the end of the matter. If there is this veto, the matter then can be turned over to the UN General Assembly for enforcement against Israel on the basis of the Uniting for Peace resolution. Right now, there is in recess a special session of the UN General Assembly convened under the Uniting for Peace resolution that can be recalled at any time. So I suspect what will happen is that after the veto, they, will recall the General Assembly, and then we'll see what happens. Obviously, the consequences for Israel could be quite serious, but of course that depends on South Africa. It's their order. It depends on what the Palestinians want. Obviously, South Africa will confer with the Palestinians, and then what the Global South will support. And I can't say exactly, but again, there could be very serious consequences.
Well, let's talk about those consequences for a minute. Sure. Francis Boyle on Code Pink Radio. So as you mentioned, we can anticipate the United States vetoing any sort of resolution for a ceasefire and for implementation of the provisional order issued by the World Court recently. And then it would go, you said, under the Uniting for Peace resolution to the full General Assembly. What is that, about 193 members? I'm not sure if it would take a two-thirds or a majority vote. It would take two-thirds. A lot of votes, right?
It takes two-thirds, Marcy.
Two-thirds, okay.
Thank you. States participating in the vote. So abstentions don't count and no-shows don't count. And okay. The previous votes, the Palestinians did have two-thirds. So we'll have to see. It depends on what is asked. I can't say.
So if you were advising South Africa in this resolution that would go to the full General Assembly, what would you want them to ask for?
I've sent them my advice. What they ask for is really up to them. But there are, and I've advised the Palestinians too, as you know, I've been a lawyer for the Palestinians for many years, there would be the following, which I've recommended for them to consider. They might go for one or more. I really don't know, Marcy, what they're going to do, but they have all my options. First, the General Assembly could suspend Israel from participation in its activities, like the General Assembly did to the criminal apartheid regime in South Africa, the former criminal apartheid regime in South Africa, and my adversary, the genocidal Yugoslavia. Second, the General Assembly could set up an international criminal tribunal for Israel along the lines of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia set up by the Security Council. This would be under the powers of the UN General Assembly to establish a subsidiary organ under Article 22 of the UN Charter. A few years ago, I did start an initiative to that effect. I lined up Malaysia and Iran to support it in the General Assembly. A large number of Arab and Muslim states rallied behind that proposal. It was sabotaged by the usual suspects, but maybe this time, in light of this order and noncompliance by Israel for the past week, the General Assembly might be able to revisit my proposal for an international criminal tribunal for Israel and, you know, start to prosecute some of the highest level civilian and military officials there in Israel. Third, the General Assembly, of course, could recommend UN member states sever diplomatic relations with Israel. Fourth, the General Assembly could recommend member states to adopt economic sanctions against Israel. Even, for example, BDS, the General Assembly could support BDS. As I'm sure you know, there are draconian economic sanctions today against North Korea. I don't support them. I don't believe they are necessary. But all those economic sanctions go back to an original UN General Assembly resolution adopted under the Uniting for Peace resolution. And then finally, the General Assembly can admit Palestine as a full-fledged UN member state. Right now, Palestine is a UN observer state along the lines that Switzerland was for many years before it became a full-fledged UN member state. I've worked with the Palestinians. It was my idea, and I did all the legal work for them on this project. In 2012, we did go for full-fledged UN membership, but the Americans threatened us, so we, you know, the Palestinians settled for observer state status. The Palestinians have threatened publicly to use the Uniting for Peace resolution to go for full-fledged UN membership. I don't know if they will or they won't. But this is very important because in the history of the United Nations, going back to 1945, no UN member state has ever been destroyed. Some have disintegrated, like my adversary, the longtime Yugoslavia disintegrated into six different states. But the Soviet Union disintegrated into 12 states, but they've never been destroyed. And this is important because it seems to me Netanyahu and his crew want to destroy Palestine. And if they get UN membership, it will make it very difficult to do that. And that
I think they also want to destroy the United Nations. You know, I mean, when you look at what's happened recently following the ICJ order, which was, as you mentioned, a tremendous victory for South Africa and for the Palestinians, for the Gazans, in the provisional measures that ordered Israel to stop this killing, this harming of 2 millions of people in Gaza, displacement, and so forth. What do we see next? We see the suspension of aid. The United States announced it's suspending aid to UNRWA based on reports that there were a dozen UNRWA employees who may have been involved in the Hamas attacks on October 7th. UNRWA has terminated their contracts. and we still don't really know where this report came from. I think it came from Israeli intelligence. But nonetheless, first the U.S. announced it was suspending aid, and then several, a long list of countries, including Switzerland, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Australia, Japan, said they are also suspending aid. So now UNRWA, the main lifeline for water, food, medicine to Gaza, has seen half of its budget eviscerated. This is the kind of retaliation that we are witnessing and the imposition of mass starvation. Frances Boyle, what do you think the consequences might be for these countries who are now actively perpetrating genocide?
Well, let me get to that question after I finish the importance of UN membership for the Palestinians. When I was the lawyer for Bosnia at the Owen-Stoltenberg negotiations in Geneva, the entire world sent the Bosnians up to Geneva to die and be destroyed. And the plan was to destroy Bosnia's statehood under international law, carve it up into three pieces, one of which would be annexed by Croatia, the other by Serbia, rob Bosnia of their UN membership, and subject 1.5 to 2 million more Bosnians to ethnic cleansing, when we already had 2 million victims of ethnic cleansing. I stopped that. And the reason they wanted to rob Bosnia of their UN membership was to wipe them out. They knew full well it would be almost impossible to wipe them out if they kept their UN membership. Bosnia today still has its UN membership. It still has its statehood. They're in very dire straits because of the genocide inflicted upon them. But all of Bosnia would have been turned into worse than Srebrenica if they had lost that UN membership. And that's why UN membership, I think, is very important for the Palestinians. I've explained this to them. They understand it. Now, as for the UNRWA cutoff, it's clear, even today's New York Times, if you read it, it was outright retaliation because the World Court, in its order, relied upon UNRWA statistics. And so Israel decided to retaliate against UNRWA. They've always wanted to get rid of UNRWA. It's a long-time objective of theirs. It was even a report in the Israeli news media indicated they had a plan to get rid of UNRWA, and that's what they're carrying out now. And if you look at, you know, who are the states here terminating the UNRWA funding, you know, it's basically white, racist, Western colonial imperial states, for the most part, the whole cabal there. What does this do? The legal consequences for these states. As you know, I was on MSNBC last weekend dealing with this, and I pointed out that those states then who have gone along with the Israeli retaliation, cutting off funding for UNRWA, basically starving to death and thirsting to death the Palestinians in Gaza, are themselves guilty of violating Article 2, Paragraph C of the Genocide Convention by themselves, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of like calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. They are also in violation of Article 3E of the Genocide Convention, complicity in genocide. They are complicit now in Israel's genocide. The U.S. government has been all along. Germany has, Britain has, but now all these other states that have not necessarily sent weapons, equipment, and supplies to Israel have become complicit. And then finally, they're in violation of Article 1 of the Genocide Convention. They all have an obligation to, quote, undertake to prevent and to punish, unquote, to prevent. And they're facilitating, they're not preventing. So you've got three different counts there of the Genocide Convention violation by these states that have cut off UNRWA.
Well, maybe if there's a criminal tribunal at the United Nations to put Israel on trial, other countries will also be put on trial, given their complicity in this genocide. Let me say, Marcy,
that is correct, because you would have, if there is an international criminal tribunal for Israel, the substantive offenses would be war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. But then there are also inchoate offenses, conspiracy, incitement, attempt, and complicity. Yes, so that could be possible. The leaders involved here who made these decisions. As for the states themselves, today, as you know, Nicaragua put out a statement threatening them with proceedings at the International Court of Justice as aiders and abettors. Remember, it was Nicaragua that won the order against the Reagan administration in 1984 to cease and desist its illegal activities against Nicaragua. And then they won a judgment on jurisdiction and competence, and then they won a final judgment on the merits. So this is no idle threat by Nicaragua, and two of the lawyers involved in that litigation are still around. I personally was not involved in the World Court litigation, but at that time, Marcy, I was advising just about every peace and human rights NGO here in the country, including being general counsel for Pledge of Resistance. I was in charge of figuring out how we used the output there at the World Court in domestic proceedings here in the United States, legislation and things of that nature, the intersection of the two. So I was in charge of that.
On a final note, Francis Boyle, I would like you to clear up something that I've heard repeated, and that is, well, you know, the World Court didn't order a ceasefire, so it really wasn't a win for South Africa. Tell us why that is not true.
Well, we have to understand Hamas is not a party to this litigation. And so the World Court could not impose a ceasefire on Hamas. If they were to call for a ceasefire, it should be on both sides. They had no jurisdiction on Hamas, and they couldn't just, in that reason, impose a ceasefire on Israel, as what happened in Ukraine v. Russia. In Ukraine v. Russia, they did impose a ceasefire, but that was because both parties to the dispute were properly before them. That is not the case here. So what they did was, if you add these two provisional measures together, as Foreign Minister Pandor said, there is no way Israel could continue its military hostilities in light of these first two measures, 15-2. It just would be impossible.
Thank you.
Although they, for these procedural reasons I mentioned to you, Marcy, they could not come out and impose a ceasefire because Hamas is not a party. They did the next best thing. And that was the language that they gave to us. It's a de facto call for a ceasefire.
Exactly. So thank you. Thank you for clarifying that.
Foreign Minister Pandor correctly pointed this out in her press conference after the order came down. It was covered on the BBC. I listened to her very carefully. And she correctly said there is no way Israel can continue with what it's doing in Gaza in light of these first two measures.
And we want to make sure that South Africa receives ample support as well as Gaza, and that this genocide end. And so I just want to remind people, if you are interested in this World Court action, this campaign to stop the genocide in Gaza, visit codepink.org/ICJ resources and learn about our delegations across the country visiting UN missions, embassies, consulates, to urge other countries to support South Africa by issuing a declaration of intervention. Well, with that, I really want to thank you, Frances Boyle, international human rights lawyer, for joining us on Code Pink Radio. It's been a tremendous learning experience, and we appreciate all of your service on behalf of humanity.
Bush and Bin Laden, you think they're foes, they're in business.